You're listening to the Nachum Segal Network, and we call this segment By the Book, brought to you by our friends at the Koren Publishers. Go to korenpub.com, K-O-R-E-N-pub.com, K-O-R-E-N-pub.com for information about everything we discuss during this program. I call your attention to a work entitled Torah and Western Thought, Torah and Western Thought, Intellectual Portraits of Orthodoxy and Modernity. And this gives us it's from Koren Publishers, a Magid release. It's actually in the Magid a label. You can go to Koren for information at their website, korenpub.com. And it really covers a variety of topics and a variety of personalities. It says here, even as the 20th century will be remembered for the West's loss of faith, Jewish Orthodoxy experienced in that very time a golden age of leaders and teachers who sought to bridge the world of Torah and that of the West. Some of these Torah figures were deeply impacted by an academic field, such as philosophy or literature. Others developed a Torah-based perspective on developments within the West, such as the rise of Zionism, democracy, or biotech, and others reflected on the very nature of religious knowledge. Torah and Western Thought presents a unique collection of essays by contemporary thinkers who paint intellectual portraits of these luminaries, illustrating how each figure bridged the worlds of Torah and the West in a unique way. Illuminating, courageously honest, and extensive in scope, Torah and Western Thought is designed to inspire Orthodox Jews and all intellectually engaged individuals of faith to learn from the lives of these luminaries and to have the courage to bridge these worlds as well. Many great thinkers examined in this book, Rabbi Emanuel Jacobowitz and the Birth of Jewish Medical Ethics, is the section of the book written by Dr. Alan Jotkowitz. Dr. Alan Jotkowitz studied at Yeshiva University, Yeshivat Har Etzion, and Yale University School of Medicine. He's currently professor of medicine and director of the Jacobowitz Center for Jewish Medical Ethics and associate director of the Medical School for International Health in Ben Gurion University of the Negev and senior physician at Soroka University Medical Center, both in Be'er Sheva. He's associate editor of the European Journal of Internal Medicine, the author of over 100 peer-reviewed papers in many different journals. Dr. Alan Jotkowitz, welcome to the Nachum Segal Network.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on, Nachum.
I appreciate that. Nice to reunite in this forum, and congratulations on all your amazing accomplishments.
Thank you.
How did Rabbi Emanuel Jacobowitz get associated with the area of Jewish medical ethics? I would think that there are many luminaries, many historical figures of the 20th century, who might be able to take on that mantra. How is it that he is so associated with this topic?
That's a great question, Nachum. And that's really how I started my article in the book. And Rabbi Jacobowitz himself answered that question. He writes, I was in Ireland, and I saw that the Catholics had much to say about medical ethics. And I asked myself, what do we as Jews have to say about medical ethics? If the Catholics have much material concerning this, Judaism, the mother of religious ethics of the world, must certainly have no fewer sources, and we should search for them and adapt and publish them. I also sought to show that in this sphere as well, Judaism had something to contribute to the moral life of humankind. So Rabbi Jacobowitz started out he was an immigrant from Germany and came to England in the 1930s. Interesting, his name, Emmanuel, he's named after Immanuel Kant. Right. He was born in the birthplace of where Immanuel Kant was born. And his father really was a follower of Rav Hirsch's Torah and Derech Eretz philosophy. And he trained his son that way. Jacobowitz moved to England, got smicha in England, and decided, like his father, he was looking to do a PhD. And he decided, because of his experience in Ireland as chief rabbi there, to do his PhD on the topic of Jewish medical ethics in the 1940s. And that's really how the whole field started.
You mentioned at the outset about his feeling, again, how real it was is something that we could examine. But in terms of being behind, in terms of watching another religion have something to say about something that we at that point had not had anything or not much to say about. What's the reason for that? Is it the usual inertia and the lack of desire to change and move ahead that often we feel in our religion that brought that about? Is it the fear sometimes of very serious halachic questions that have to be answered that made us slow down in that procedure? How would you examine that we would be perceived as behind compared to others?
Again, another great question. It's not that we were behind, really. It's just that the information was collected all over in numerous different sources. It was never collected in one place. And that was really, there was hundreds of tshuvos written on questions of medical ethics. But what Rav Jacobowitz's greatness was, again, before the Bar Ilan CD and other computers that make it much easier to gain information, he was able to collect all the relevant Jewish sources and put them in one place. But there's also something interesting about this time, because medical ethics really started right when Rabbi Jacobowitz was starting to enter the field.
That's true, right. Right, go ahead.
Really for two reasons.
Right.
One, before in the 1920s, and there really wasn't much that medicine had to offer. It's interesting. You might have been better off not going to a doctor or the hospital before the 1920s to be put with sick people. It really was the start of penicillin, that medicine really has something to offer patients. George Washington died. He shouldn't have died, but one of his doctors suggested, let's do bloodletting. And that was probably the worst thing to do for someone who was infected like George Washington. So medicine really had nothing to offer. The second reason was the technology started booming in the 1940s and 50s. The question of whether we should intubate someone, whether make someone DNR, whether we should use artificial reproduction. They weren't relevant questions. No one knew or thought about these things. So really, when Rabbi Jacobowitz entered the field, he collected the information, and it came right at the time when the questions started coming to fruition.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Dr. Alan Jotkowitz is with us. The essay is Rabbi Emanuel Jacobowitz and the Birth of Jewish Medical Ethics. We're talking about the Magid book release, Torah and Western Thought, Intellectual Portraits of Orthodoxy and Modernity. And I don't mean to seem frustrated when I reiterate the question, but again, it just seems that end-of-life issues, abortion. We talked today about stem cell research. I don't know. To me, it always, as a regular guy, it always seems like it just takes us a long time to draw these conclusions. And very often, of course, we don't really draw conclusions. There are still many arguments that go on forever, so to speak, in many of these areas. I was going to say, and I wonder if that's a good thing, a bad thing. Often we know that the back and forth in discussion in Judaism is really a positive thing. I mean, our whole Talmud is based on it. But sometimes, I guess, again, as the average guy, it can get frustrating when we just don't know where Judaism, how Judaism feels about a specific topic.
That's exactly what I spend my day, maybe that's question, thinking about and writing about in my work. When you really look, and I mentioned this in my article, in the book, there's, even within Orthodox Judaism, there's fundamental disagreements on the most basic medical ethics questions. For instance, abortion, like you mentioned. Rav Moshe Feinstein is very, very machmir on abortion. Certainly does not allow it after 40 days except for threat to the mother's life. For Rav Waldenberg is much more vacuous on the issue of abortion and allows abortion in Tay-Sachs fetuses and other disabilities and other reasons. What does it mean to have a Jewish medical ethic when we have so many different kinds of opinions and even opinions that disagree on the fundamental issues? On end-of-life care, it's the opposite. Rav Waldenberg is very, very, I don't know if you use machmir, but he really does not believe any patient should be DNR or DNI. Every patient, we should fight for the last breath. Rav Moshe is much more open to if patients are at the end of their life to not being aggressive in their treatment. So how come we have this religion with so many different opinions on these basic questions? And I think that gets to the beauty of Judaism, that at a certain level, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Torah was given, and then HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave it to the great rabbi sort of to build on it and to develop their own ethic from the basics of the Torah. But it does create a problem when you have such differing viewpoints. And the stem cell question is even a more difficult question. Someone asked me, what does Judaism think about cloning? So how do you even approach that question? Where do you find the sources? I can't open my Shulchan Aruch and say, what do we think about reproductive cloning and stem cell research? So what is a Rav or a Posek supposed to do in that situation? And those are very difficult questions, the questions that I and other medical ethicists think about on a daily basis.
I can only imagine. And I don't know, it just seems that there's so many varied ways of looking at things. The more we get into the technology, the more variables are included. It must be, I don't want to say frustrating, because you'd probably resent that, but it must make things even more difficult to examine as we continue further and further along.
The questions get very, very more difficult, and not only theoretical questions. I'm really, most of my time as a doctor, and they're much more difficult when you're dealing with real-life patients and real-life families, and you have to answer and address these questions, and the complexities, every case is really different. Rabbi Jacobowitz also made one other point that he thought about Jewish medical ethics. My intent is to a Jewish contribution that will influence all of humankind in terms of how it looks upon life and its meanings. The mission of the Jewish people is to function as a signpost for the whole world. This is Kiddush Hashem before the non-Jewish people. Rav Jacobowitz really felt that we had something to contribute to the whole world on this question of medical ethics, and that's another reason why he published his book.
Final minutes with Dr. Alan Jatkowitz. The book is entitled The Torah and Western Thought. He has the article about Lord Emanuel Jacobowitz talking about medical ethics. Does time have a lot to do with a lot of these things? And I don't mean to, God forbid, demean a rabbinic authority by saying that, you know, as time goes on, it's easier to either, you know, decide a certain way or change one's mind. But it seems to me when it comes to organ donation, when it comes to maybe stem cell, we could say the same thing. When it comes to autopsies, an attitude toward autopsies and when you might actually allow one or specific types of, you know, things to be done to a body. It seems that the more time goes by, the more comfortable people get with some of these regulations. Is that a fair thing to say?
Very fair. Rav, yes, I mean, halacha tends to be conservative in a lot of ways and move slowly on some issues. You don't like to rush into the things. Rav Moshe was very much against heart transplantation when he started. And he probably was right, because the results were dismal. And there were a lot of unethical things being done in the beginning of heart transplants. But Rav Temler claimed that with the success of heart transplants, it's almost up to 90% five-year survival right now, that there Rav Moshe changed his mind. And he saw the success of his procedure led him to Paskin that it became mutter. So that's definitely a fair assessment, what you have to say. Just want to make one final point. Sure. My article is just one article. And I'm honored in this great book that deals with Rav Cook, the Rav, Rav Aaron, Nechama Leibovitz, Professor Tversky, Rav Amital, Rabbi Lamb, and Rabbi Lichtenstein, these great figures of the 20th century, and also written by tremendous contemporary scholars, who I'm really honored to be in the company of. And I'm really excited about this book, I have to say. I was so happy that to get my first copy to read through, and I really recommend it to everyone. It's really a fascinating read to read about these great people.
Well, it is incredible. Your article is among them, and it's greatly appreciated that you mentioned the others. Well, we are going to explore some of the other topics and personalities as well. Dr. Alan Jatkowitz, the book is entitled Torah and Western Thought. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Nachum. My mother's a big fan.
I greatly appreciate that. You make sure to send her our best. More coming up. You are listening to the Nachum Segal Network. And part two of our program, by the book this week, with our friends from Koren Publications, or Koren Publishers, I should say. We're talking about the Magid book release with YU. It's a Torah and Western Thought, Intellectual Portraits of Orthodoxy and Modernity. You can go to the Koren website, korenpub.com, korenpub.com. Again, a Magid books release. And it does examine, this book has an amazing and incredible array of writers examining some of the incredible personalities of recent Jewish history. And Dr. Yael Unterman is with us via telephone. holds a BA in psychology and Talmud from Bar-Ilan University, an MA in Jewish history from Touro College, an MA in creative writing from Bar-Ilan. She's published pieces in a variety of genres, including prose, fiction, poetry, and book reviews. Her first book, Nechama Leibowitz, Teacher and Bible Scholar, was awarded the category of finalist in the 09 National Jewish Book Awards. Her second, The Hidden of Things, a collection of short stories revolving around the search for personal and religious connection, was published by Yotzeret Publishing in 2014. She's an international lecturer and creative educator, facilitating workshops in bibliodrama and experiential technique that has been likened to spontaneous midrash. She's performed a solo show she authored, After Eden, The First Family Conflict, in venues worldwide. Yael Unterman, welcome to the Nachum Segal Network.
Thank you, Nachum, and thank you for the honorary doctorate, but I'm not actually a doctor.
Oh, did I say, if I said that, I apologize.
It's okay. It makes me very happy. Why should I sit for 5 years if people will give it to me anyway?
Yeah, we'll leak the information to your relatives, so at least it'll be worth something, right? There you go. So you have I would assume you'd call it a privilege of being part of this incredible work, Torah and Western Thought. Professor Nechama Leibowitz in the Revolution of Bible Interpretation. Why was her approach revolutionary? There are so many who've analyzed the Bible. What is it about Professor Nechama Leibowitz that allows us to call her interpretation revolutionary?
Well, you see, there's a problem even with the title, because Nechama would not have accepted the word revolutionary. And actually, in my book, upon which this essay is based, I make it clear that she was more into evolution than revolution. And that was, I think, why she succeeded, because she didn't make a big fuss and she didn't, put on lots of lights and bells and whistles. But the truth is that if you actually look at it, there was something revolutionary about it, and that's why we chose the title. And I'll try, it's a little bit nuanced, but I'll try to explain what I mean.
Okay.
There's a couple of factors. The first one is, to your listeners, this is going to sound strange because we're all so used to this way of looking at things, but the whole kind of let's read Rashi, let's read Ibn Ezra, let's compare the two methodologically, let's ask, what was Rashi saying, what was Ibn Ezra saying, and then move on. That wasn't done in her day. She was the one that initiated that. So what seems very, very boring and normal in our eyes is actually something that she created. So that's the first issue, is that she systemized our study of commentary. And before that, people would just sort of read and nod and carry on, and they wouldn't try to analyze in depth why one commentary kept saying certain things, what his philosophy was, etc. Some people have said that what Nechama did for commentaries is what the Brisker Rav did for Talmud.
Wow.
So that in and of itself is extremely important, and it's a revolution in how we approach the commentaries. So that's one facet. And then B, there's another facet which is called the literary approach to Torah, to Tanakh, which today is quite trendy in academic departments around the world, literary approach to Bible. At the time that Nechama was around, sort of in her earlier years, earlier decades, in the sort of 30s, 40s, 50s, it wasn't being done so much. There was a school of literary analysis in general literature, not in the Bible, but in general, called the New Critics. You'll have heard of T.S. Eliot and others. And they were doing some of that work. And then there were a few people who thought, let's also apply this to the Bible, to the Torah, and let's see what we come up with. And found themselves very attracted to that approach. And Nechama was one of them. She learned her tools from folks like Buber and Rosenzweig on the one hand, and her friend Meir Weiss, who was an Israeli scholar, religious Israeli scholar, who very much pioneered this approach. And she was doing all of that long before it was trendy. And the weird thing is that she wasn't recognized for it in particular. People don't understand that she was actually doing that, because she didn't write a book called, Let's Study the Torah in a Literary Fashion. She just did it inside her essays. So you have to be aware that she did it. And that's true of some of the things that Nechama did. You don't know that she did it until you actually stop to pick apart what she did, and then you say to yourself, wow. So So that could be another facet.
So help me along with this. And I know that part of this you just answered, but I want to organize it for a second. So the comparison of the way different commentators approach, that is something that she that is something that she introduced. It gave birth to what? In other words, if she would have been, and I don't know her history, so you could tell me if she was or wasn't, but if in theory she would have been the head of an academia, if she would have been the head of an academic institution, it would have been similar to what? Is there something, you know, comparable to today that has taken on this type of academic activity that she introduced that she would fit right into its leadership? Let's put it that way.
I can't pinpoint one thing because it's really the entire academic approach does this. What does the academic approach do? It says, let's not just read things. Let's go in depth. Let's try and analyze why the person is saying what they're saying, what their philosophy is, how they're consistent across all that they're saying. And people write doctorates about that. So on some level, what Nechama was doing was sort of introducing an academic or pseudo-academic approach to what was previously a bit of a balagan. She was a yekka, and she was making seder, right? She was organizing it all so that we could understand what on earth is going on in this jumble. The difference between her and an academic is that she wasn't interested in the history of the commentaries that she was studying. She was very ahistorical. The way it's phrased, she wasn't interested in what pants Rashi wore. I'm British, so I would say trousers, but I'm translating it for your listeners.
Thank you.
And she was actually adamantly opposed to, like, finding out what Rashi's Christian context was, you know, where he was polemicizing with the Christian. She wasn't interested. She just wanted to know what Rashi's philosophy was when he was reading the Tanakh. So she was partly academic, if you want to call it that. That is the academic approach, is to be methodological.
Yeah, understood. But it's funny because, you know, the world doesn't exist in a vacuum, nature, nurture, etc. It is so common for so many of us to look at the approach of certain commentators and look specifically at their geography or the conditions with which they grew up or the conditions in which they lived, whether rich or poor, you know, agrarian or not. And none of this would play a role in her analysis.
Right. And that's a very, very interesting thing, because it's not to do with her being religious or not, because there are other religious people who are very interested in the background, what we might call realia, the geography, the history, particularly Rav Yoel Ben Nun. His way of studying Tanakh was completely founded on those things,
right.
And that's why he was basically, I don't want to say at loggerheads with Nechama, but there was a very great tension between his school and the Nechama school for many years here in Israel. And the Bagrut, the Israeli matriculation, was being taught according to the Nechama approach, which was very painful for the people who wanted to know what the geography and what the history was. But Nechama said the Torah is not a novel, and it's not a history book, and it's not trying to teach us about 3 days' journey to here and what this person wore. And, you know, if you were to bring in all kinds of little pots, you still wouldn't have learned more about Yaakov. You know, she says that a person reading, you know, Psalm 23, Mizmor LeDavid, who then stands up and tells you a whole thing about shepherding and explains all about shepherding, hasn't understood the Mizmor at all. But the person lying on their deathbed who says, read me Mizmor LeDavid, he's understood that. So she wanted to know what the text was teaching us. And that went with this literary theory. And she didn't want to know, you know, what the text, Near East comparisons, how it was similar to, you know, Ugaritic. Like, it just wasn't her thing. It crept in very, very little into her work.
The book is called Torah and Western Thought, Intellectual Portraits of Orthodoxy and Modernity. It's a Magid Books release, korenpub.com, korenpub.com for information. Yael Unterman is with us, Professor Nechama Leibowitz and the Revolution in Bible Interpretation. I'm sure there are many, and you and I may have had, I don't know if it was you and I, at one time we discussed the challenges of being a woman in this world of Jewish academia, religious academia. What could you tell us about the way she approached what would normally be as an outsider to all of this?
She She wasn't really an outsider because she had spent many years steeped in the world of academia in Berlin. She was in Berlin between the ages of 14 and 25, and she was basically doing her doctorate for a lot of that in the universities of Heidelberg and Marburg. And she was very au fait with the academic way of thinking. But the interesting thing is that she partly accepted it and partly rejected it.
Right.
Something about her religious upbringing, you could even say something calling from her soul, didn't enjoy where academia, the final station that academia brought us to. She said she made fun of somebody who wrote her doctorate on whether people in Shakespeare's time believed in ghosts, and the bottom line of the doctorate was, some did and some didn't. She said, well, what was the point of that? So that was really interesting. She was able to integrate academic thinking and be an academic. She was a professor at Tel Aviv University. But she, at the same time, critiqued academia from within the place, you could say, maybe the religious place, because she said, we need more. Like, we want to get more from it. So I think she did a very good job of straddling those worlds. She was a very good harmonizer. She was able to have one foot in one world and one foot in the other and not feel as if she was splitting apart, which I think is amazing. She wasn't a person of angst, you know. It's very different from Rob Soloveitchik in that way. She just got on with it, you know.
She went with the flow, huh?
Resolving the contradictions. Hmm?
She went with the flow.
Yeah, you could say that.
Yael Unterman, she's got the essay on Professor Nechama Leibowitz and the Revolution of Bible Interpretation, part of this Torah and Western Thought, Intellectual Portraits of Orthodoxy and Modernity, Magid book release. You can go to Koren Publishers. It's korenpub.com, korenpub.com. Done with Yeshiva University and the Zahava Moshe Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought. Thank you so much for joining us today and helping us analyze this.
It was my pleasure, and I want to echo Dr. Jotkowitz and say that it's a really amazing book, and it's really an honor to be in this book as well.
I appreciate that. We're going to be we'll spend a minute or two here just reminding everybody that Rabbi Yitzchak Herzog and Rabbi Emanuel Jacobowitz, we mentioned Professor Nechama Leibowitz, Rabbi Yehuda Amital, Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, Rabbi Soloveitchik, Aaron Lichtenstein, just part of the Rav Cook, of course, both Rav Yosef Soloveitchik and Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, all part of this analysis that we entitled Torah and Western Thought, Intellectual Portraits of Orthodoxy and Modernity. Magid book release with Yeshiva University's Strauss Center for Torah and Western Thought. And again, you can go to Koren Publishers at korenpub.com, korenpub.com for information about this brand new book. It is really amazing. I thank all of you for tuning in to the Nachum Segal Network. Buy the Book is brought to you by Koren Publishers each and every week, Wednesdays here at the Nachum Segal Network. The book is entitled Torah and Western Thought, Intellectual Portraits of Orthodoxy and Modernity, and you are listening to the Nachum Segal Network. ¶¶